The method.
Ideas. Method became
unsound.
Are my methods unsound?
Without doubt. Do you call it unsound method?
I don't see any method at all.
Hello, and thank you for joining us for the 8th episode of Unsound Methods with me, Jamie Batchin.
And me, Lachlan Bloom. For those of you who've not listened to Unsound Methods before, this is a podcast where we speak to fellow writers of literary fiction. We're both authors ourselves and really started this podcast to kind of get under the skin a little bit about the process and their motivations for writing.
Yeah, and this week we were joined by Will Eaves. Will is the author of books The Oversight, Nothing to Be Afraid of, This is Paradise, The Absent Therapist, The Inevitable Gift Shop, and most recently Murmur, which was published this spring on CB Editions.
I have to confess, I've not actually had the chance to finish reading Murmur by the time we spoke to Will, but I have since and thoroughly recommend the book. We had a really fascinating conversation when we met Will in Farringdon in April this year.
I think it was April. It was chucking it down, so it seems appropriate enough.
Yeah. We talked about Will's writing routine and his use of imagery and metaphor to focus his writing.
We also covered trying to capture the unconscious dreamlike aspect of the mind in fiction and the benefits of working with a small publisher. And now, ladies and gents, Will Eaves.
I guess if we maybe start, talk about your routine a bit. Have you written anything today?
No, I am taking a break at the moment because I've just finished this book about, well, it's a novel loosely based on the last years of Alan Turing, but the routine does vary. And when I am writing, there are kind of two parts to it, really. One is the rather ad hoc process of reading and notation, which can take place at any time. And that sort of process of collating material and thoughts is as likely to occur on the tube or on a bus. Sometimes it's more likely to occur there as it is in my study or at the university. And then there is the rather more formal elaboration of the notes, or if you like, the writing of the fiction itself or the poetry. Although even that can't really be tied down to a particular time of day or a particular planned method of composition. I think what is true is that generally speaking, I'm thinking about something at least semi-consciously most of the time. So I'm not such a believer in large amounts of allocated time, but I am a believer in repetitive habit.
So what would some of those repetitive habits be? What would...
Well, as I say, there would be quite often public transport is involved. It's something about being in limbo that allows you to visit those parts of your imagination that are freed from responsibility for a while. So I think that's a very good time to catch things on the wing.
And when something comes along, how do you recognise, oh, this is something worth noting down?
I don't think you do. I mean, you think, well, you sort of hitch your wagon to a star. You it's a bet that this sounds interesting at the moment. It may or may not prove to be interesting later on. But it goes into a sort of large notebook, and the notebook is then sort of filleted later on. So, you don't know, really.
And is it ordered within that notebook, or, I mean, are things in...
No, the notebook is simply filled. It's just gradually filled.
In order as things...
Yeah, and then what tends to happen, actually, is that once an idea begins to crystallise and sort of form some kind of shape, and we'll probably come back to the business of shape, which is very important for me... once that happens, I tend to go back through the notebook and begin to write new versions of the notes, not yet really having a very fixed idea of what these new versions are in terms of ultimate form, but just wanting to sort of tease them out, write more sentences around them, see how the paragraphs build up.
And how long would a note be? I would say you're on the tube and... an idea appears to you, would it be sort of two or three words or two or three paragraphs or
probably a few words. Sometimes something has occurred to me as a result of something I'm reading at the time, then I sort of write a little sort of small critical response. And very often, of course, it's overheard conversations. Hmm.
So the notes would be a kind of just to remind you of the feeling of
they're a sort of shorthand, yeah.
Yeah.
There's a very good essay now, I think, out of print by Hilary Mantel called... she doesn't write so much criticism now, but she's a very good critic, apart from anything else. And the essay is called Growing a Tale. She makes the point that writing is a little bit more like tapestry than anything else. It's composition in the way that the word composition suggests. It's a gradual stitching together.
Mm. And thinking of tapestry, that you generally be weaving one piece, but obviously with words, you might be. You mentioned you're working on a piece about Turing. I can imagine lots of writers might work on five or six quite different projects at the same time. Do you have a sense when you think of a note that that's related to a particular project, or more, this is an interesting observation and I'll see if it fits with the Turing project or the space opera or
the crucial thing to realize is that you won't know at the time. You won't know at the time. That will only be revealed in retrospect. I don't write anything with a sense of its immediate utility.
So from the notes that you write, for something like Murmur, for example, where it is a kind of coherent piece, I'm comparing that with, say, The Absent Therapist, where it is more fragmentary. Mm. And I know you have particular feelings about fragments from having had previous interviews with you. Do you know that... Are you writing things down that are a sort of a flavour of a character that you're getting attached to and then the themes emerge, or do you know... How far do you know what you're heading for when you begin compiling notes for something like
my answer to that might be sound a little unhelpful in that I know less and less as I get older. And all the elements of fiction writing seem to me to be ultimately indivisible or coeval. So you don't have an idea of a literary form into which you pour the content and characters and dialogue. What you find is that they determine each other as you go along. Or at least I find that. Now, some people plan very rigorously and they do have character charts, plot developments. But I find that if I do, and I've tried to do that, the difficulty for me is that then I find the energy goes into this... sort of planning superstructure rather than into the work itself, or rather I miss the, it's easy then to overlook the fact that really one's planning is the writing. That is where the energy is. And that the distinction between the two, between the provisional, the planning process, and then the dialogue and the characters is a false distinction.
Mm. And would you see that distinction between the sort of emotional themes of the novel, is that a false distinction as well between, say, a sort of overarching theme of...
Well, they certainly surprise you, I think. You know,
it's not something you'd ever think, that I want to write a novel about this feeling or emotion.
I don't think that quite works. I think it can be a prompt. I think many things can be a prompt, and you have a hunch that something speaks to you, and it's something that you can... you have the ability to tease out, you have the ability to investigate. I'm quite a social, even mildly extrovert person, but I'm also extremely solitary. And over the years, in a way, I've become more solitary, and the business of writing has enforced that solitude, solitariness. And so when I to a number of different sort of reading sources and events came to think about Turing a couple of years before his the centenary of his birth, around about 2010, or even earlier than that, actually. I had the sense that this person who was struggling both with a sort of profound physical and mental change in the last years of his life, and with a sense of injustice, struggling to communicate it to anyone, and dealing with the room of his consciousness and solitude, was a situation I had at least some inkling of. Clearly, Turing is an extraordinary mathematical, you know, genius, and I'm just a hack. I'm just a jobbing writer. So in a sense, it's a sort of, it's important to me that this is a fiction murmur. It's not the story of Turing's life in any way, because I'm not, I have to respect the distance and the discipline and the rigor of his intellect. But I do feel that something in my psyche responds to his late situation for reasons I can't quite discern, and which actually slightly alarm me.
But it sounds as though you had that.
But it's, that is an emotional thing.
From,
as well.
Yeah, that emotional interest was from the initial reading of it. So you wouldn't have been surprised in the way of, say, starting to write about Turing and then discovering you're writing a story about his next door neighbor who was having an affair and was a spy or something. You were wanting to follow that thread, and that was the interesting emotional, conceptual.
That's true. Aspect. I mean, I did want to do that, but on the other hand, you, in order to make any kind of character or situation interesting, you sort of triangulate it. You want to know what it looks like from another point of view. That's part of what you need to make any kind of character come alive, I think, is you need another or preferably two other points of view. So, of course, the invention happens around the main character very often. You know, the people who give you that, the secondary characters who shed new light upon your protagonist, if that's what he is exactly.
With Turing, before you thought, oh, I'm going to write a piece about this, what then flipped you into thinking this is going to be a novel or this is going to be a work of fiction? What?
I think time does it. I don't know that my... I'm not aware of very many decisions being made very consciously. Mm. I think they're all made semi-consciously, almost as if they're all made in that strange twilight, you know, moment of waking. That's kind of where the interesting stuff happens, I think.
So is it almost retrospective, you suddenly realize, I'm writing this?
Yes, it is, absolutely that. I think the other way I've described it, at least to myself before, is that it's like something coming into focus. It's like a sort of panning shot that suddenly halts and the image has a chance to catch up with itself and sharpens, and you can see what's in front of you. And that applies also to selection of material, if it's indeed selection that's happening. You know, you have these ideas, notes, and sort of beginnings of characters, and you have situations that are evolving, and everything is sort of in play. And then it might be the case that you go somewhere, you read something, or something happens. There's a just change in the light, and suddenly you sort of see what the shape might be of these things and how they might attach that shape, how they might belong to it. Now, at this stage, you haven't got much of the book yet. You don't even know if it is a book. But what I tend to then start carrying around in my head is a kind of mental image of something, you know, like, what is this kind of structure? Is it like a chain? Is it a necklace? Has it got fingers? Has it got 10, you know, chapters, like sort of, you know, the five fingers on each hand? Is it a diptych? Is it two panels? You know, that's the sort of way I begin to see a book taking shape.
And are you continuing to take notes during that period?
Yeah. I mean, I take notes all the time. So.
And how did that image of the shape reveal itself to you with Murmur? Because was it a novel you were working on from which you decided to create the short story that begins it, or was it a short story first that you then felt you had to further explore?
No, the thing is that beginnings are endings and endings are beginnings. And actually, the first chapter, which is the first chunk of journal, actually I wrote last of all.
So, that's interesting.
Actually, it's the hallucinations and letters that form the main 150-odd pages. Excuse me. That were the bulk of the hard work.
Mm-hmm. So that, in a way, that was the research and preparatory work for a short story. Had you wanted to keep it at that level, obviously it's a novel that's the work that you were working on.
Yeah, I mean, I did know that they would all sort of join up together in the end. I mean, interestingly, the actual object I had in mind from a reasonably early stage, once I'd hit on the idea of having mysterious letters alongside these hallucinatory revisitings of episodes in the scientist's life, the object I had in mind was a necklace. It was a kind of a necklace with jewels or stones clasped by facets, silver thing, you know, so that the clasps are the letters and the thing they enclose are the stones. And this kind of rather sort of mineral, gemological, you know, visual metaphor. The advantage to having things like that is that it makes you feel the thing already exists. Mm. When you haven't yet got a book, you can sort of put some trust in this quite imaginatively tangible idea. And it represents something you can go to and say, ah, oh, right, I'm doing this now. Which bit of that? Am I working on a facet now? Am I working on a stone? How's it going to look together? And it takes some of the pressure off you as a writer, thinking, God, I've got to do all this work. I've got to write thousands and thousands of words, and I don't know how I'm going to do it. Just that simple thing, which is nonverbal, of an image, sort of calms.
And that can be any image. I mean, it doesn't...
Once you have a sense of sort of what the project is, then you need to sort of stabilize the image. So after a couple of chapters and about four or five letters, I realized I had this sort of chain necklace thing going. I knew that was going to be the book.
But this sounds quite a rich metaphor in the chains clasping the gems. And I could imagine that relating to a lot of ways and how the words and paragraphs build up. But imagine other images that are just purely an image
it's different for every it's different for each book. I mean, to my mild horror, I realize I've written a few books now the shape is different, you know, for each one, and it performs a different function. So I do have a different process each time. I don't want to make it sound as if I have this kind of, you know, fixed.
Find the spirit animal and then
it doesn't really work like that. And some of it's much more. The truth is, you've got to be very wary of what writers say about this whole thing. I'm sure other people have said that, because there's a lot of retrospective, management of the situation to make it sound more coherent than it really is.
But I think that's what's really interesting to hear the retrospective rebuilding of the process. Yeah. It's so different from, you know, everyone we've spoken to so far has a different approach and different way of doing things, and whether that is how anyone actually does it or not is another question.
Have you heard the marvellous, I mean, one of my favourite ones of this, just so it doesn't all sound so elaborate, is the great interview that Muriel Spark gave to, I think probably was the BBC, but there's an excerpt, it's probably on YouTube somewhere, of her talking about her method. And it's, I begin and then I write on every page like so, I type it up and then I set, she writes it and then she sends it to her secretary to be typed up, and then she makes her corrections, then they are incorporated, and then it is sent to the publisher. That's it.
It's that easy. That's all there is to it.
You're not going to get anything else. And I love that. Because in the end, of course, it does boil down to that. Yeah. That is what you're doing. Except none of us have secretaries anymore, but, you know, I write longhand and then I type it up, and then you make more corrections than you send it off.
And with that sense of a kind of material metaphor for the structure, is that something that you have always worked with when you've written fiction, or is that something that you've realized as you've gone through the books, that the idea of the necklace, for example?
Yeah, was that retrospective? Did you have an image of a necklace and then as you were thinking about it more realized, oh, the clasps?
So no, as I said, it kind of cohered about sort of two or three chapters in, and that tends to be what happens, you know. The everything is provisional, but certainly the early stages, and it's like waiting for a sort of molten mass to cool and become solid. That's what you're doing for the first. I mean, because I take an inordinately long time, it takes me about a year or 2 years to even get started on something.
And what sort of signals the start for you? You've taking notes and filling notebooks.
At what point
does it come into focus enough that you go, okay, I'm now writing a part of the book?
I sort of couldn't tell you really, because it varies each time. I mean, the first book I wrote, I remember writing a kind of self-contained chapter to start, which is about some sexual escapade. It was a very thinly disguised version of something that had happened to me, feebly disguised. And I thought it might be the beginning of something, but at the same time, I knew it wasn't very good. So I wrote something very different, which involved the same character, but at a very different stage of his life. And it had lots of responses to the first chapter in it in terms of characters. But actually, in the end, I realized that I had to just drop the first chapter, and the responses were interesting because for the reader, they alluded to a sort of, you know, life to which they weren't yet privy. Mm. And that was actually a much more exciting way to introduce the character than to have all this sort of prefatory material about his, you know, sex life, which was actually rather dull and prosaic. And so I got rid of it.
I feel like there's something more honest and realistic about that, for whatever that is worth in fiction, giving a sense of that, because you don't experience life with all the sort of previous justifications and the causal links. So I think that's interesting to then go and erase that kind of.
Yeah, you're always dropped into it in medias res, aren't you? So, you know, something is already happening. And in the same way, I think that, you know, I believe in, well, I believe in getting out of situations and chapters and books while things are still happening.
Mm.
You know,
not resisting
the temptation to leave things in a static, in stasis, which this is the problem with, you know, with, I think, a lot of approaches to that horrible word, structure. It's the notion that there has to be, you know, there's the motivating this, that, and the other, and then there's the development, then there's a resolution. And I think you can't be certain that that's the way it's going to work.
Mm. And I mean, I think going back to what you were saying of the retrospective element in the way writers describe their work, I think that's something that's true in life in general. It's a lot of what we do, it's only in retrospect that we come up with the reasons that we did it, and at the time, well, we didn't know.
So I mean, I think there is something just to put it simply, but also, you know, meaningfully, there are two things in life, aren't there? There's planning, there's the determined. If I do this, such and such will eventuate. Mm. You know, if I subject this particle to that force, it will go over there. And then there is the unplanned. And there's not knowing what will eventuate. And the problem of free will, if you like, you know, the ability to change things. So you're always dealing with planning and with play. You're always dealing with the determined and the uncontrollable. Mm. And that's the case for every artist, and indeed it's the case for every person. So
yeah, and I think there is a strong, a more commercial fiction, there's a strong pull to tie everything up neatly, which I think often makes it work a lot weaker than actually reflecting the way that people do experience things.
I think there is with work that doesn't actually quite work. It might be very popular, but it's not really. I'm not being a snob about it, but it's the case with things that are, they think that's the thing that matters. I think the really good genre stuff tends not to do that and can also be extremely popular, but is rather more interesting and open-ended. I'm just coming to, I forget his name's slipped my mind now, but there's a very popular thriller writer in America. I think it's rather good. James wrote The Tin Roof Blowdown about Hurricane Katrina. Shamefully, his name is just momentarily having a senior moment. But I thought that was firstly very well written. It's partly a procedural thriller, but it's also a meditation upon chaos. The kind of the catastrophe and the sort of explosion of gang warfare and loss and mayhem and racism and in the wake of the disaster. And it both resolves and it doesn't resolve, because the sort of issues it's thrown up are still chaotic.
I guess that is the
body politic,
To kind of have some resolution, but not.
So I think the best, genre work is actually very, well, I mean, again, the distinction between the literary and genre work is sort of false and meaningless. You're just interested in the good. I mean, more or less any writer you talk to would, for example, acknowledge that Elmore Leonard, was by any measure, a brilliant writer.
I think it was James Lee Burke.
James Lee Burke, thank you.
The internet told me that wasn't my brain coming up with anything. But I think, maybe that's the thing the kind really of intangible thing there that makes, even if, I was about to say, even if something is genre fiction, that's, again, betraying a sort of snobbery on my part, maybe. But that makes something satisfying and is quite hard to put the finger on. Maybe it's that lack of a sort of false catharsis within it, the resolution at the end. Because, I think I agree with that quite strongly. But I wonder if, do you teach creative writing?
I do.
How do you teach your, as much as you teach creative writing, do you discuss with your students this sort of feeling about structure, or do you take them through the kind of steps of what's conventional and learn the rules before you break the rules? Or are you happy for them to?
Well, I can't really. The thing is, I don't think teaching really is about telling people things. I think it's about, it's leading them to writers and writing and encouraging and listening, really. I think that's the main thing. They can only do the hard work themselves. I can't do it for them. So I'm not really all that keen on trotting out various, one could do it, and I do have handouts and so on, but I'm not really that keen on it. I think I only began to realise how things were put together once I'd read a sufficient variety of things and thought about it long enough. I was in my mid-30s, really, before I publish something. And it just takes a long time, and there isn't any shortcut to that.
And reading is
Reading is the most important part of writing. Reading is much more important than writing.
Do you read back your notes often, or is it more the process of writing the note down is?
Oh yeah, no, I do. I read back my notes quite a lot. Yeah, because I'm always sort of adding to them. So.
So you might take a note that's a few lines and then expand that to a page of...
So for the last book, I'd have quite a gnomic scrawl about, various problems to do with consciousness and Thomas Nagel and Daniel Dennett and so on. And then I would revisit those things and try to put them in a voice, try and see what they would sound like in a dramatic voice being said, being thought. And then gradually a character one hopes comes into view.
And once you have a sort of section, that can be quite fluid in where it goes. You might have it initially, three or four pages that you think is going to be the start, but it ultimately ends up being in the middle, and something you thought was going to be
in the middle ends up being the start. Yes, I think I'm sort of quite, I'm quite systematic when it comes to the sort of chunks of writing I do once the whole thing really gets going. I'm quite addicted to the 5,000 word chapter. I think of that as my sort of optimal length for the exploration of a situation or a journey or some incident and its consequences. It seems to be something I'm, you know, it's my, that's my canvas. That's my standard canvas. And it changes. Some are obviously 10,000 words and some are much shorter.
But would that be written as one sort of in one bout of writing, or, you know, in the space of a week or something, you'd get those 5,000 words down?
Well, it depends how a very long bout, the longest, the longest bout you can imagine. I mean, I think that, you know, it takes me. There isn't a set answer to that, but, you know, a couple of months.
I guess meaning you'd concentrate on one chapter and get that.
Yeah.
And then you concentrate
then
on another one.
Then you go on to the next one.
And then the order relative of that might be chapter two and chapter three, and you swap them round to chapter three and chapter two, respectively. Or
you don't necessarily know, but I want to write from the start to finish, and that's the intention.
Mm.
But that isn't necessarily how it works out in the end, because you then find that actually the thing you write last belongs at the front, or you have to sort of chop off, you have to do some sort of quite radical surgery, normally to do with the beginning and the end, I find.
But when you're doing that surgery, it's mainly moving chapters. You wouldn't sort of take a scene that happens in chapter four, say, take that scene out and make it happen later.
It's got its own organic development. You know, there's a reason for the things being where they are.
Yeah.
I think.
I saw the time approaching when I would be left alone of the party of Unsound Method. The pilgrims looked upon me with disfavor.
We hope you're enjoying this episode of Unsound Methods. Remember, you can follow us on Twitter at Unsound Methods or via our website at unsoundmethods.co.uk.
Has there ever been a question for you whether you would be a writer or do something else? Or is there something you see unique to fiction writing as a mode of expression that you can achieve that you wouldn't be able to achieve doing anything else?
The short answer is no. I'm not very invested in the whole idea of being a writer. That is not to say that I don't take it very seriously. I do it as well as I possibly can. Rather, I do what I can, which is by definition as, you know, as well as I can do it. But I don't see myself as a writer. I'm rather with, you know, I think that it pleases me to reflect on certain things, and I find it stimulating, I think, to make a formal narrative shape of certain intellectual considerations and many feelings. And I do see mind as passion as much as anything else. I think I'm with George Eliot on that one. I think that, you know,
because you were established as a critic more before you started writing, or before you were published.
I was an editor, really.
Within the world of literary criticism rather than you said you first were published in your mid-30s. So.
Yeah, I mean, I worked at the TLS from my late 20s, so I wrote reviews for a while. I edited a lot. I never wrote an enormous amount of literary criticism because it's actually a very difficult discipline, I think.
And were you writing notes with a view to writing fiction throughout that period?
I think I was learning, really. I mean, I was, yes. I wrote for a review, I would write extensive notes. I think most young people who start out do, because you're so aware of, you know, what you're in this uncomfortable position, which, you know, I only gets more uncomfortable, I think, as you get older, of, you know, pretending to a view about people who are writing who are much more experienced than you are. And you want to sound as if you know what you're talking about. But of course, really, a large part of you knows that you are learning and that you don't know very much at all. And that you're piggybacking upon the work of people who are vastly more experienced. Now, that's the way it's always been. And of course, it is a very good way of learning. Mm. But there is an element of, it's not exactly bad faith, but there's an element of, there's an unfortunate side to that, you know, which is that you advance opinions with greater confidence than you in reality possess.
That makes the world go round. Or it seems to be. Everyone seems to be relying on that.
That's the way one learns. Mm-hmm.
And do you feel there's a difference then when you're writing fiction? Is there a more immediate reality to you knowing this is right? Because only I know if it is right or wrong, do you have the same doubts of, just copying or advancing, writing this bit of prose that actually it's because I read something that I liked yesterday? And
I think I feel increasingly uncertain, but uncertainty isn't necessarily a bad thing. You know, I'm sort of certain about the uncertainty, if you see what I mean. Mm. I think that it's, I don't want to know what it is I think I'm capable of. And it may very well be that when I next come to consider writing a book, if I do, I will find that I've dried up, and that I've done 7 mercifully brief books, and that might be it. That's a possibility. Mm. And I don't mind that. I think that's, I want to be truthful to the need in me, whatever it is, to fashion something. Mm. And I don't ever want to do it because someone else or some extraneous motive says it should be done.
Mm-hmm. So that suggests that you're not yet working on a new project in terms of a long piece of fiction.
Well, not consciously.
Okay. So yeah, well, I was going to ask about that. Does the note taking then have a phase for the project that it relates to, or would if you had an idea now about something, would it tend, do you, in your past experience, to then link to notes you've previously written and not used, or would you have to sort of have a blank slate and start afresh?
A bit of both, actually. You do have a blank. You do, you know, you get a new book, and you sort of, you know, sharpen your pencils and you get things in order and you start looking at new material. But quite often you do find stuff. I mean, one of the interesting things, you know, I think that most writers have is the way certain stuff, certain things, themes, people even keep cropping up. Mm. I think that's how you build your own private fictional, you know, genealogy, your family, a tree of characters. There's a sort of bloodline of the imagination that flows through books, the books of one author, mm. but it's not willed exactly.
Mm. And what are the significant changes to how you've worked on projects from the beginning? Because I think when we spoke on the phone before, you sort of said that you were quite conscious of a change in how you work that's happened. So how would you describe the sort of the major points of that?
Well, I think in terms of just very, very practical process, I used to write a chapter longhand with lots of, you know, deletions and incomprehensible scrawl in the manuscript. And then once I got to the end, I would type the whole thing up so that I had a sort of growing type draft of this book as I was going along. And it helped me to feel that I'd at least reached the end of one section before I went to the next chapter or gemstone or whatever.
You know? So you do that by chapter?
I do that by chapter. Type up.
Right.
And it is a little, it's a little more... So it was the longhand, it was the writing, that you know, the sparkish writing, the typing, and then putting to one side. And now it's been a little more it's been a little more chaotic for the last few projects. I've had binders of notes, second drafts of notes, sections written at greater length, longhand chapters, and then typescripts. It's become slightly more chaotic isn't the right word. I mean, I know I'm working towards a shape. I always have a shape in mind, but the actual sort of written tools that, you know, the pages and the, and that part of the process is a bit more varied and unpredictable than it has been.
And is that, do you feel more comfortable in that? Do you
no, feel I feel considerably less comfortable.
And is that, maybe that's useful in itself.
Is that just from the necessity of how those projects have been, like deadlines and how they, or how they've come about? Or if you feel less comfortable, would you, what's stopping you to go back to the previous
because
way
I
you
think
did things?
I'm trying to... I'm trying to get at what I don't yet know.
And that's what you need to do to get there.
I mean, there's a sort of, this is putting it rather simple-mindedly, but the transition from the unconscious material to the conscious is a very strange one. And, of course, at the point at which it becomes written and decided, it's no longer the former. But the dream is to sort of preserve within the written book the traces of that kind of oneric and, you know, dreamlike logic that make prose fresh and interesting for the reader and makes it feel like something new and not like something they read before.
So as someone who writes quite, let's say, unconventional novels, not sort of mainstream conventional fiction. I don't want to rub you the wrong way with that.
Things that don't sell, James. How, we can say it.
How important has your relationship with your publisher been for that? Because obviously the last three books have been with CB Editions.
Yeah.
Do you think it's more difficult to find a home? I mean, we've talked to several other writers. We tend to focus on indie presses about this kind of silver age, I think, the folks at Gallivag are referring to it. But does that, is it important that there are these publishers around willing to give you the space, or do you think you would still be writing the things you're writing anyway?
Well, I think I'm very lucky to have made this relationship with Charles Boyle, who runs CB Editions. And although I had good, I mean, very good times, very lucky to be at Picador. I mean, I think that, you know, the truth is that the books didn't sell and it would have been, you know, quite difficult for them to give me another contract for something as something like Murmur, which is, you know, I mean, actually, funnily enough, I have got an American publisher for it, which I didn't get for any of the other books. So that's interesting. I mean, a little bit of a surprise. But at any rate, you know, there are commercial considerations, and if you've not sold in three books, you know, it's a big ask, I think, for those large operations to throw more money at you. And they can't, because they are bigger operations, they don't have that sort of flexibility to work very well on a small scale. Mm. That's what they consistently find. Whereas if you are someone like Charles, who's, you know, a really excellent writer himself, and an editor, and a typeset, he does everything, and someone with whom you're going to have a kind of personal editorial relationship, of course, is just a really lovely experience. There's no getting around it. It makes you feel as if you've got someone who really wants to produce what you've written. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's an enormous sort of relief.
And with that, the editing side of things, you were saying that you don't have so much of a routine when you're actually writing, but do you have to give yourself a block of a set number of weeks or something to really sit down towards the end and do that?
It's a bit different with each one. Because I rewrite so much as I go along, really by the time I get to the end of the first proper draft, that's sort of what the book is going to be. Mm-hmm. And then there's still a lot of work to be done, but it's quite detailed work. It's quite sort of intricate.
Just sort of roughly in terms of time, how could you compare the proportion of time that you spend getting to that first draft and the proportion of
To write the book takes that takes most time. I was writing The Inevitable Gift Shop alongside this one. And I would say that let's see, when did I write the first chapter of this? I think 2012. So it's taken me, and then I've finished that. Realised I had a book, basically, or hoped I did before I showed it to Charles in May last year.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. So 2017, five years.
Yeah.
And then, it's about 5 years.
And then a year on top of that for the sort of the more detailed finishing.
Yes, it was about six months.
I'm sure that's not a completely unique time frame, though. I think that's just down to personal things, isn't it? I saw David Peace. I hadn't read the article yet, but it was on The Guardian. He was saying about he couldn't believe that he wrote 8 novels in 10 years or something. I guess some people can do it.
I think some people are, you know, some people are sprinters and some people are, you know, walkers or long distance. I mean, I'm a kind of dribbler. I don't write very long books. That doesn't seem to be, that's not my canvas. That said, you know, maybe that will change.
I want to cheerlead for shorter novels, though. We talked about this with a couple of other people. I think it's really that they're hugely underrated.
I just don't, I feel quite sort of liberated now into saying, and I think it's just having turned 50 in a way, I like the very long novel. I mean, I love the very long novel. I can't quite see myself doing it.
Mm.
But I do think that every kind of sort of large scale and broader sense fictional project is a process of gradual accumulation.
Thank you, obviously, for coming all the way out here in the rain.
Pleasure.
Where can people find out more about you? Do you have things on social media?
I do. So the books are, the CB Editions books are at cbeditions.com, and there's a bit about, you know, this is an information page about each book there, which is each of the ones I've done with Charles.
And we could recommend, just very quickly, as you know, being published with CV Editions, I think I would like to recommend that people buy books from publishers.
Yes.
Because that's pretty much the best thing you can do
it
to
is,
support
yeah.
this sort of writing.
So cbeditions.com, hi you there, oh listener, and part with your pennies. And it's post and package free. Oh my God.
Thank you for listening. That was episode 8 of Unsigned Methods, and you can find Will at Will Eaves on Twitter.
Yeah, I feel I should just say at this point that after my ringing endorsement of buying books from publishers, which is obviously an excellent thing to do, support your local independent bookshop as well.
Before we get inundated by angry booksellers across the country and around the world.
Loving your work, guys. Loving your work.
You can find me online at Lachlan Bloom on Twitter or lachlanbloom.com.
And I'm at Jamie Batchin on Twitter or jamiebatchin.com on the internet.
Thanks again for listening, and catch you next time for episode 9.
Cheers. Talk to you next time.